So I think we're ready to kick off the session. Today's speaker is Dr. Stephen Handel. Dr. Handel received his master's and PhD at Cornell University. He currently is a professor at Rutgers University and the director of Center for Urban Restoration Ecology. Dr. Handel focuses on rebuilding native habitats. And this is his second time doing this internet seminar. The first time there were such good reviews that we decided to offer it again. I was lucky enough to hear that internet presentation and see him speak in person. So I know you're in good hands and you will enjoy this presentation. So before I turn it over to Dr. Handel, can I remind you one more time to put your phones on mute? If you don't have a mute button, hit *6. And please do not put us on hold. Okay. Ready, Dr. Handel?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thanks.
Hello, everyone. Welcome from sunny New Jersey, where I'm sitting today. I'm interested in ecological restoration. Restoration is a newer field in modern ecology, and it aims to bring back parcels of land into their ecological health. You know, conservation means saving the few pieces we still have, which are functioning with historic vegetation. Restoration attempts to bring back more little pieces, as you'll see, for our citizens' benefits and for general environmental health. I've gotten very interested in studying very, very degraded parcels, some of the most stringent lands in the country, to see what could be done with them. And, of course, this is so congruent with the mission of the EPA that we've started talking about this to meetings and with these webcasts. Let's go to slide 2. This is a kind of a site that we've gotten very interested in as targets for ecological restoration. This happens to be a closed sanitary landfill with a venting pipe for methane in the foreground. This is a site which is very interesting to me. It's an ecological disaster, but it's an engineering success. This is a site where the garbage has been covered by cap, and then soil was put over the cap so the cap doesn't get degraded in the sun. And then grass seed was hydroseeded, blown on, to stop the soil from eroding during rainstorms. So everything done here was done for a specific and appropriate engineering goal. Cover the garbage, maintain the cap, keep it this way static for a very long time. When I went out to this site, which was hundreds of acres, I realized that the biodiversity was just a handful of grass species, some fescues, and it was very, very poor habitat for wildlife, very, very poor habitat in terms of providing the ecological services that healthy natural sites can. And of course, for the public, for the American public, it's an ugly site. It fulfills one public health function, which is sequestering solid waste, but it's not a site which you and I would enjoy really hiking on, having a picnic on, or doing any other programmatic needs. What can we do to sites like this within the purview of the EPA, within the budget that we have to remediate sites, and add something back to the American public? The next slide, number 3, is a snapshot I took in Connecticut. It could have been anywhere east of the Mississippi, and it shows a sequence of healthy habitats which are not maintained by any person. No budget, no staff. In the background is a normal woods, nothing rare and endangered, maybe a dozen tree species, maybe 20 shrubs, and 50 wildflowers and grasses. In the middle of the slide is a pasture, a cow pasture in this case, very, very different plants, different kinds of grasses, wildflowers, all living together with no management except for the herd. And in the foreground, which looks a little rougher, is a wetland full of rushes and sedges that have naturally invaded and are surviving quite well there in the moist soil at the toe of slope. I like this slide because it shows a natural slope, and the distance from that wetland marsh to the background is maybe only about 200 or 300 yards. And it shows a plant biodiversity of hundreds of species being used by hundreds of insects, maybe 150 kinds of birds over the year, and so on. and it's lovely. A site which is functioning, sustainable without any management budget or directives, and serves many public needs, not only as ecological services, but also aesthetic and programmatic. Can we bring sites like this back to the EPA degraded sites that you and so many of your colleagues work on? The next slide shows what we call in our field ecological services. So often parks and meadows are thought about by the general public just as an aesthetics place, a place to go to have a picnic or for some people to watch birds. But in fact, of course, natural habitats have enormous benefits to our country and to our civilization. Natural stands of plants purify the air, get rid of particulate problems, cool the air. They maintain the healthy water table under the stands by allowing water to percolate down, to be purified in the soil, and so on. Natural stands mitigate against droughts and floods by controlling flashing after heavy precipitation and release moisture back into the soil slowly. Habitats also play a major role in our soil health. They stop soil erosion, which is a major problem in many parts of the United States. And a healthy habitat generates new soil with the slow accumulation of leaves and other litter that breaks down with microbes and so on. So healthy soil for the long future depends on healthy vegetation. Nutrients are used and trapped by habitats, stopping the eutrophication of our streams and ponds, which again is a major problem near our population centers. And finally, of course, even in cities as well as in the countryside, stands of trees cool the air, add humidity, and they stabilize the climate. It's well known now in a lot of the urban planning circles that if you have street trees, it's not just for shade. It also stops the need for air conditioning, for example, during the warm months. And so the value of those trees is enormous, even though that value is not often stated on civic budget sheets and not part of a city economy. These are things we're stressing more and more as we encourage government at all levels to restore habitats to land which is generally empty. Our interest is mostly with native plants, not just any old thing you can get from Joe and Josie's nursery. And the reason for this is practical, pragmatic, and economic. Native plants, which have evolved in our country from place to place, have evolved tolerances for the local stresses. So they offer, over the long term, the greatest ecological value and the greatest appropriate habitat for wildlife that migrates or lives in each of our communities. Alien plants, which are used abundantly in the horticulture trade, are not so good at this. They have offer less habitat value, and they often need more help, more care, to be maintained over a long period of time. It costs money to use them. The second bullet says that native plants are essential for biological diversity and ecosystem integrity. By that I simply mean that they harbor the most numbers of insects, which are the base of many food chains, and they harbor the right kinds of subtle differences for our native mammals and birds. Ecosystem integrity means that sites that we add with native plants will mesh in with the parcels which have been preserved in parks or in wild areas. The economic value of native plants is enormous. They offer us sometimes food as well as recreation, low maintenance, so you don't have to tell your client or your trustees you'd better budget in perpetuity to keep this healthy and reproducing and so on. They cost less money after the initial installation phase. And finally, we want ecosystems and habitats that regenerate, that are self-sustaining. So you and I, as public servants, don't have to go back into these areas and replant and fill out more paperwork and get work crews in there and start watering as you often need to do during the initiation stage. Self-sustaining landscapes are what we're really aiming at. This has gotten the attention of many agencies. If you go to the next slide, the second why native plants slide. There's even a White House executive order that was put in place by the Clinton White House and still is active, which encourages all agencies in the federal government to use native species on all their properties and to control invasives. And this is getting a tremendous attention, even for big landholders, the Defense Department, which controls millions of acres, Interior, of course, and so on. Invasive species, as we'll get to in a few minutes, are degrading every habitat in North America, from Yosemite Valley and Yosemite National Park to Central Park in Manhattan. And this is becoming a major threat to all of our lands, and those of us who work on degraded lands have to pay quite a bit of attention to them. This history of vegetation and habitats in North America is getting worse and worse, and the next bullets show that many, many of our plants, the backbone of our habitats, are rare, going extinct, and are threatened as more and more people cover up the land with new uses. The next slide shows a strip mine, if you could please go to that.
Which is slide 7.
Thank you, Ellen.
Sure.
This shows a kind of habitat that I've worked in. It's not just landfills. This is a strip mine in southern West Virginia, which had a very rich coal seam. And the operation here by the corporation was to blast off the mountain, the sandstone, dig out the coal seam, and then cover up the land with crushed sandstone, treat it with some fertilizer and hydroseeded blown grass seed to regreen the land, which is required under our strip mining laws. In the background of the slide is a natural West Virginia Southern Appalachian forest. This forest actually is the most rich in terms of biodiversity of any habitat in North America. It was replaced by this grassland, which is very, very poor, unsustainable land. This is a site where restoration to try to get back to that oak forest, which could give forest products for the people of West Virginia in perpetuity, would be fabulous. What can be done to degraded sites like that to start the process, the trajectory, to bring it back to a self-sustaining forest for beauty, for wildlife, and for local economy? I'll go to the next slide, number 8. This is another example of a site which we work on that can be restored. This was a public works project, in this case the city of New York, where a sewer pipeline had to be put in to replace a very old one which had cracked and was spewing out sewage. A ditch was dug, a new high-tech pipe was put in, land was graded flat. This also now is a site above this pipe which could be restored to something. In the past it was just weedy with the common reed, Phragmites. This was an area which we could bring back many, many kinds of species to be used by native wildlife and to enrich this community's ecological structure. The next slide, number 9, shows a waterfront site. In this case, it's also on the East Coast, near the Hudson River. And this site was really an abandoned port. It wasn't doing well. All the containers, ships had moved elsewhere. But it's right on saltwater. It's near where millions of people live. As you see, it's abandoned warehouses, asphalt, riprap. What could be done here to bring this back to seaside, natural habitat of public value? So these are sites where restoration ecology should be brought into play. The next slide, number 10, shows a beautiful habitat, but it's one that's rather different from restoration ecology. This, of course, is a beautiful public park full of tulips and trees, and it's a lovely place to walk through. This is not restoration. This is landscape. This is ornamental horticulture. The difference, of course, is in process. This slide of the beautiful public park first takes a lot of money to maintain. Endless gardeners, fertilizing, fussing with those tulip beds, a lot of public money going to keep it looking just like this. It's static in the sense that it doesn't change from year to year. The trees get a little bit bigger, certainly, but there's no new species coming in. When any of those trees dies, it isn't allowed to fall and rot in place, supporting insect life. It's taken out. The tulip beds are carefully maintained by the gardening staff. The kinds of things we think about in natural habitats are not there. There are some wildlife. There's certainly some songbirds in those trees. But the process of that the bird community is involved with is not present. If they bring in seeds from elsewhere, those seeds are raked up or seedlings are cut down during mowing. There's no change from year to year. Even the ground is maintained with fertilizer, pesticides. It's meant to look neat and clean. Compare this to a natural forest, which will change from decade to decade, some species leaving, other species moving in. Nothing is spent there if it's self-sustainable land. That's what we're aiming for, not a manicured park like this. What are some of the problems that we have to deal with? Please go to slide 11. This drawing shows a typical urban area, and most of the United States is urban now. That's where our citizens live. In fact, within the next 20 years, two-thirds of the people in the world are going to be living in urban centers. So the need to bring back ecological services to most people in our country and the world is becoming enormous. I like this image because it shows how we structure our lands. Most of this slide is sort of beige, and that represents us, where we live, where we work, our roads and other infrastructure. The only natural habitat giving ecological service are the little specks of green that are scattered around. Some of them are parks, some of them are wildlife preserves, but they're quite isolated. This is a fragmented world that we now live in. For me, as an ecologist, I worry about this because it's very, very difficult for plant seeds and animals to move from one patch to the other. Good Lord, here in sunny New Jersey, they'd have to cross the Jersey Turnpike. Not a recommended thing for a small mammal or a dicky bird. What can we do to add back more little green patches to a map like this so that there are corridors for migrations and movement of species? This becomes really important in ecology because any one of these patches may have a problem, may burn because of vandalism or natural fire. Or one of these patches may be rezoned into a strip mall. We always need another strip mall in New Jersey. In that case, how are we going to get critters and seeds to move from one of the remaining patches to the next? What can be added back to enrich this landscape? Next slide, please. This one shows a photo of a very degraded landscape in northern New Jersey, rather near Newark Airport and Giant Stadium. It's called the Meadowlands because once upon a time this was a very healthy marshland full of white cedars and so on. But through different land use changes, it's completely changed. What you see in this slide is all too frequent near our population centers, highways, railroad sidings on the left, other landfills. So that center sort of kidney-shaped thing is a 20-acre landfill. To the left of that is a whitish higher landfill. There's some marshland on the left side of the slide, and that's a degraded Phragmites marsh and very polluted water. And on the right side is a very, very dense town of Kearney, very little green resource there. It's not Yosemite National Park. It's where people live. It's where so much of EPA's remediation work is done. And it's a target for possibly bringing back native habitat and wildlife and ecological services. I've studied here because we said, let's pick the most stringent, difficult site we could find. What's possible there? The next slide, number 13, is on the ground on that central old landfill. It had been abandoned for 20 years, really wasn't taken care of, and over the years there was some erosion, there was some vandals setting fires, and this is what we were left with at the beginning of our study. A lot of the old sanitary, just household garbage is now on the surface, broken glass, tires, bikes, and so on. I sometimes tell people I'm an in vitro ecologist, meaning that I seem to be planting in broken glass half the time. In the background is some of the buildings of Newark. But on the site, what is the vegetation? It's a few alien weeds that were brought in from Europe, and in the middle, one ailanthus, a very weedy tree from Asia. this is not anything like the historic vegetation of the eastern United States. What can be done here? The first thing, of course, is the soil. We're never going to get a sustainable habitat, whether it's meadow or woodlands or shrublands, on a place that has such terrible soil profile. Well, what can you do if you work for a federal agency or an academic institution, you have a very, very tight budget or no money at all, and you have to cover 20 acres like this with some sort of a healthy soil profile? Even where there is some soil, it's really not very good. The next slide shows the conditions we have on soil near brownfields, human population centers. The soil is usually terrible. It's been used by people for literally hundreds of years. From place to place, it's variable, depending on what was dumped there last or what was built there last. It's highly compacted from decades of tractors or buildings on site. Chemically, it's changed because of air pollution over the decades. It tends to shed water. It's hydrophobic, so water runs off rather than being absorbed to be available to plants. The pH has changed because of air pollution. It's usually acidic, or it sometimes is alkaline if it's got concrete chips mixed into it. Because it's compacted, it has very poor aeration, very poor water drainage. You know, living plant roots need oxygen. They're living tissue. Many of the soil organisms are gone, so the normal cycles of breaking down leaves, cycling nutrients, is just not gone. Often there's pollution like heavy metals or hydrocarbons, the things which are the meat and potatoes of EPA officials. And since it's surrounded by people and roads, it's really quite hot. And this, of course, interferes with microbes, invertebrates, and plant health. So it's a terrible place to be a living thing. What can we do to remediate that as part of the restoration problem? Please go to slide 15. Well, that site I showed you in the meadowlands of New Jersey, which is not atypical from so many other parts of the country, we needed some soil for it. Where'd we go? Well, I'll take Manhattan. We found a place where there was a construction site, and they were digging out soil for the footings of a new skyscraper. Manhattan was once upon a time covered by a glacier. This turned out to be the riverbed of an old glacial water body. The contractor had to dig this out and dump it, and it would cost them, of course, to tip it somewhere. And we said, if you bring this soil to our restoration site across the river, you can dump it there for nothing. So we saved this contractor hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we got this rather clean soil. It had been buried for 13,000 years, of a very good quality. It was a sandy loam. And this started for us the restoration process. Next slide, please. This is me in the middle of the slide, on site. That soil from Manhattan had been spread across the site by that big dozer, but of course it lacked any organic matter, which is important for soil health. This was a glacial river at a time when there was very little biomass in North America. It was a mile-high glacier. So where do you get organic matter if you have very little money? Well, happily, more and more sources are becoming available. In this slide, this is compost brought in from a suburb, Teaneck, New Jersey, I'll give it credit, and they were collecting yard waste year after year and just letting it rot in one of their public work yards. We said, you can haul it down to my site and dump it there for nothing. So we got 20,000 cubic yards of well-composted leaf litter, which is perfect as an amendment to the soil. There are other amendments now becoming available nationally. There's another course in this series that talks about biosolids and paper pulp waste, which is available more and more throughout our cities. The conditions for decomposing it and treating it so it's healthy and not there's no public resistance is getting better and better. These kinds of sources of organic matter are available and should be used on the sites after EPA does a cleanup. Next slide, please. This is one of our guys that uprooted a tree on one of these old landfills to answer a very critical question that I'm always asked. They say, hey, how much soil do we have to put on after we do an EPA cleanup or after we're covering a landfill or a brownfield? soil, it, even if you get it for free, it still has to be hauled there, has to be spread, and so on. Well, the easy answer, of course, is that the more healthy soil, the better. The thicker the soil mass, the more it absorbs like a sponge water so that the dry summer months aren't stressful for living plants and animals, and so on. But often you can't get a lot of soil. In fact, if the soil is high quality, the right chemistry, organic matter, pH, and so on, you can get a healthy habitat there with just a few inches of soil. This guy's holding up a tree that's growing on 4 inches of soil above a pyritic clay cap that's covering a landfill. And on this 4 or 5 inches of soil, we had oak trees that were 20 feet tall, birch trees that were 20 feet tall, and so on. The roots stay in the top healthy soil, and they spread out like a pancake. It's not the best, but it's still a functioning habitat. So don't be discouraged if you can only get some good soil for your sites. We've all seen, I'm sure, seen road cuts in all parts of America where you have a nice forest growing on just a few inches of soil above the bedrock. This is common in the Rockies and New England and so on. The more soil, the better. Don't be discouraged if you can only get a foot or so. Most landfills require 2 to 2.5 feet above the cap, and that's a good rule of thumb, is the minimum that you should aim for. Okay, once soil is in place, we want to start dealing with how do you bring back vegetation that's appropriate for your site without spending a lot of money. Please go to slide 18. I'm going to talk about a case study we did, again, on a very, very difficult site in the city of New York. In fact, it's the Fresh Killed Landfill, the biggest sanitary landfill in the United States, about 2,000 acres. It sits at the edge of Staten Island near New Jersey. Of course, the city fathers and mothers in Manhattan didn't want that garbage near them, so they put it at the edge of the city on a salt marsh. At one time, of course, salt marshes were not protected. Now they are by many, many federal and state laws. Please go to the next slide, 19. Well, isn't this gorgeous? This is Fresh Kills today. The dumping there is over. Everything above the water is household solid waste. The highest mounds here are about 160 feet above the old salt marsh, and there are 4 such mounds. Look at the landscape around this landfill. It's just terrible. Industrial parks, waterways, composting facilities, trucking facilities, and so on. It's really pretty ugly. I'm the guy who loved plants when he was a kid, and I end up working at sites like this. How does this happen? Well, given this site, what can we do that's economic, that satisfies the public need, and that also covers up this garbage? Fresh Cove Landfill, of course, was hated because it's so ugly and it's 2,000 acres. The people of Staten Island couldn't stand it and would do anything to get it closed, and in fact, they eventually elected someone who closed it. That was Mayor Giuliani. The site was hated, and my work there was sort of obscure until at last we were attacked. Slide 20, showing the World Trade Towers, shows an interesting moment in how attitudes change. After the horrible attack and the towers came down, you know, the steel and the concrete was recycled, but everything else, the, you know, broken desks and so on, were hauled away by barge to Fresh Cove. It was the only place they could put such a humongous mass of material. So Fresh Kills moved from a landfill to a place which harbored the debris from the towers, which of course, alas, was the ashes of 3,000 New Yorkers. So the site suddenly became effectively a cemetery and a place of great feeling and importance to the people in New York. So turning this landfill into a beautiful public park is now a high priority. How do you do that? Now that we have public interest, the city is willing to put some money into it, and people are willing to consider Fresh Kills more than just where the garbage was. It's a place of great emotion for people in this region. Next slide, number 21, shows the first of our investigations towards bringing back healthy, beautiful habitat to this site. This site shows the existing landfill with a whole series of little flower pot labels in it. And what we did here was ask the simplest question. Look, we want to bring back healthy habitat for ecological service. Can we just knock the seeds in the ground? That's the cheapest thing to do. So each label here represents a place where our team put in several or dozen seeds of a different native plant species. We have about 25 trees and shrubs represented here. And we ask the question, well, if we just bring in the seed, will things grow up and then we'll have eventually the endpoint we want? The next slide, 22, shows the results of the experiment. Around each of the labels, we went back regularly and just counted how many seedlings came up. These are oak seedlings, white oak. And we went to see just how successful would this be towards restoring the American landscape. The next slide, 23, shows the results, which I'll go through quickly, and the answer was that this was a disaster. Even though we put in about 10,000 seeds, we only got about 0.5%, 1% of all the seeds growing up into seedlings. This shows the winners of this particular experiment, the ones that actually had some seedlings after 3 years' growth. I'll do it fast. Aronia's chokeberry, 1,250 seeds, one seedling. The next is hackberry, celtis. Oh, that was a winner. About 20% of the seeds made seedlings. That's a plant that does very well in dry, sterile soils. The next corn is the silky dogwood, 0.5%. Flowering dogwood, 0.5%. Lindera spicebush, 0.5%. Quercus's white oak, 27%. That big acorn did okay in these crummy soils. Rus sumacs, about 2%. And these are the winners. We had another, 15 species or so, which had no seedlings after 3 years. The story here is that restoration is whole cloth. Even though we put in the right seeds, the right species, with the soil so poor, because it was just to cover up the cap, and that grass seed was put in to keep the soil in place, that was a terrible competitor for our seeds, we couldn't get anything going. We have to start with the appropriate healthy soil and not hydroseed. Hydroseed takes up space and resources and challenges native plants that we want from coming in. First the soil, then deal with the plants. The next slide, 24, shows some berries from a native tree. Again, we didn't want to just plant these 2,000 acres. Nobody has money for that, and civic money is needed for other things. What ecological links could we bring in? Well, the first link we said was, can we get birds to bring in seeds? This is a natural part of ecological succession. Birds eat fleshy seeds like this, fly around with them, and then the seeds come out, either through their throat or through their bottom. It's just like you and I eating an apple and then throwing the core out from the window of our Chevy, or if you're a professor, from the window of your Mercedes-Benz. This is a normal part of ecology. Any textbook would say early in the development of habitats, birds and small mammals bring in seeds from fleshy fruit to start biodiversity on the land. Could we get this link to come in the nation's biggest urban area? Again, a very stringent site. The next slide, 25, just very quickly shows the idea. The dotted line here shows where do seeds end up if birds carry them. Most seeds end near the y-axis, near the mother plant. But occasionally, piles of seeds are found at a distance. That's called recruitment foci here. That's where the birds are roosting or nesting, and they bring food back to that. For many of our native trees and shrubs, that's about 20 to 30 meters out from where the seeds are produced. The solid line simply shows the trajectory of wind dispersed seeds. That's straight physics, the weight of the seed versus the wind speed and so on. And that tends to be a leptocurtic or a normal distribution. We're trying to get those piles of bird dispersed species to a new site which is relatively barren of vegetation. Okay, number 26 shows what we did and what I recommend many of you do on your sites. Put in small clusters of some native plants that act as attractions to the bird community to bring in seed. Also, we planted things that themselves make lots of fleshy seeds very early on, so this becomes the nucleus of new populations of these species. Birds come there because they now have a place to roost, to be protected. They didn't have that on that old grassland, and they can spread out seed. In this particular case, go to the next slide, number 27, this is what we planted. This was appropriate for the eastern U.S. Common plants, trouble-free, they all have fleshy fruit that attract birds, and they all make a lot of fruit early in their life cycle. You really don't want a tree that you got to wait 20 years before it makes any fruit. That's just slowing down the process. These are easy to get from many nurseries, which are now stocking native plants, and they're relatively low cost. They're not, you know, of great horticultural interest. Right. So that was an attempt to start that link in nature, getting free birds who are not paid, like landscape architects, to bring in species to your site. The next slide of plants in nursery pots is a little story I want to tell. We're very interested in, when we start these restoration sites, bringing in as many varieties, as many genotypes as possible for long-term persistence. We're encouraging the best nurseries to grow up many varieties of plants for ecological restoration. The more kinds you have, the greater the sustainability. So if you have a wet year or a dry year or a year with a lot of fungal disease, some of the plants will still live because of resistance or tolerance. And this is an active area of research now, trying to get the right genotypes for small, urban, and degraded sites. Okay, so we have these plants and we knock them in the ground. The next slide, number 29, shows this experiment, and it shows another public issue we're dealing with. On this site, instead of just putting in 20 identical patches, we tried a bunch of small patches of 7 plants, patches with 21 of 42, and some large patches of 70 plants. The question here is, if you're trying to bring back biodiversity and ecology to a remediated site, how do you do it with a small budget? Should you have a lot of small patches or a few big patches? Which function the best? Which really live and grow and spread the best? And let me just show you some of the results of this investigation, which I think is very relevant to many of our sites. Slide 30 shows one of my patches with the kind of data we collect. This was a patch of 21 trees and shrubs on an old landfill. Again, look behind it, roads, tank farms, terrible place to be a plant. The first thing we said, are dicky birds really bringing in seeds? So we put some seed traps, just pieces of canvas on the ground, and regularly went back to it to see, would birds be bringing in seeds to this patch? Would they ignore the big patches and so on? The next slide, 31, shows the data, if you will, the seeds that we collected from the traps, and these can be identified to species by someone who's had some botanical training. What did I expect? We had 65 traps on this site, each about a yard square. And I said, good Lord, I hope we get some seeds. Well, slide 32 shows what we did find. It was extraordinary. Even at Fresh Kills, the nation's biggest landfill and industrial zone, we got over 14,000 seeds in these 35 traps. Orders of magnitude more than I thought we'd get. The seeds listed here are ones that I didn't plant. They weren't part of our initial planting. These are all seeds that were brought in from somewhere in this region by birds. All of these are native plants that are appropriate and much desired on this site for beauty, for ecological service, for the ability to spread more. So we had, as you see, about 20 species brought in the first year. The last line, 14 from outside plots, represent traps that we had just in the open grassland, and there was hardly any seeds there. Birds are not stupid. They're not going to go sit on the grass, which is dangerous with their enemies, which offer them no food or shade and so on. They hone in on these patches as much better habitat. So this link in nature could be brought back even in a terrible setting in year one. The next slide, 32, forgive the Latin, are the kinds of plants we saw brought in. I show you the long list just to show you that it's an extraordinary ability, and if we can do it on this landfill, you can do it on your other sites, which are closer to more natural settings. Also, some of the plants here are ones we do not want, and I just have to mention that. Some of the genera here, Celastris is bittersweet vine, Ailanthus is a tree of heaven. These are things we really will grow fast and take over the site. They're aliens. Let me just say a little bit about it because it's become part of all our work. Slide 34 shows one of these bittersweet vines in a small city park. What was once a nice oak tree is now covered by this vine. It's like kudzu in the southeast. It was brought in from Asia because the seeds were pretty. And it just has no natural enemies, and it sweeps through our habitats, destroying biodiversity. It covers up plants, kills them in a few years, and then you're left with the monoculture of this one Asian vine, which is not necessarily good habitat for our birds and other critters. It also doesn't allow anything else to move in. These alien species are now public enemy number one in the United States. Almost every state now has an invasive species council that is trying to deal with letting people know not to plant these species. What do you do when you have them on site? What can be done to stop additional species from moving in? The next slide, 35, lists some of the five or six most common ones that came in at fresh kills, and these are terrors throughout all our eastern cities, and again, have to be stopped at great expense. The next slide, number 36, shows that invasive species are threats to all our basic habitat types. It's not just wetlands or oak woodlands. Whether it's moist forest, upland forest, coastal habitats, or wet or dry meadows, the frequency of alien species is becoming greater and greater. That's what these dark bars show. And this is not just unique to this one habitat where we had good data for 100 years. It's true throughout the United States. From California to New England. So this is something we all must manage even in year one. There's no management during restoration. There's not zero management in restoration. There's always some need for management to knock out these invaders until our native populations can shade the ground and stop future invasions. Well, enough of the sermon. Let's go back to 37. 37 again shows the slides with all the seeds, and the question is, well, you know, what happened over the years? And we continued monitoring the seed fall for 3 years, and we found a sad story, which I really repeat because I think it's relevant to all of your work. The next slide, 38, shows what happened for the first 3 years of the study. The first bar on the left shows the data I've already reported, about 14,000 seeds, about 25 species on site. It was a great success. The next year was a regional drought, and no surprise, the number of seeds was much lower, although the number of species stayed high, about 30. The next year, 96, was a great year, a beautiful weather all summer, moist, plants were growing beautifully, many seeds made throughout the whole region, and we thought, again, we'd have 15,000 seeds in the traps. We didn't get that. It stayed relatively low, 4,000 to 5,000. Number of species, about 21. What happened in the third year? Well, in that third year, around my study site, one of the little remnant forests had been cut down. I'll go to 39. Here you go. This is a little woodlot between the landfill and the dense suburbs, only a couple of acres. Most of this was cut down to make a strip mall. Another pizza shop, which I do enjoy, and other little stores. This was a little habitat remnant which was not protected by any law. It wasn't a wetland. There was no rare or endangered species. And it was not part of park. It was just open land which could be developed. So even though on paper or legally it had no value, except as an industrial site, a commercial site, it had enormous value ecologically. This is where the birds lived that brought out seeds. And the seeds they brought out were from the plants and this little remnant. When the remnant was chopped down, the ability of seeds to move about and restore the landfill on which I am standing really went down a lot. So at some point in our land use and our thinking about the landscape, we have to give value to these little remnants. More to the point, if you're working on a restored site, and here and there is a patch of shrubs or native trees, please try to protect it with a silt fence. Don't put that, you know, where you're going to keep your material, or your trailer, or you're going to stockpile stuff for your own work. Try to realize these small patches of native plants become the jump starters of ecological restoration elsewhere. They are of great value. Next slide, number 40. Okay, we knew birdies would come in, bring in seed. But what about, you know, the long term? With the plants that we were starting, that were, or were starting to go, would they reproduce themselves? Would the whole process of population growth, the growth of numbers, continue over the decades? So we did a very simple study. We looked at the flowers of the things we planted, and we said, are they really making seed? Are pollinators coming to this site to produce seed and then allow these things to make thousands of new seedlings on the site? The next slide, 41, shows a little bee on a wildflower. Quite simply, we did get about 50 bee species coming to the site in the first 3 or 4 years. These are bee species which moved in from somewhere in Staten Island, probably from people's backyard vegetable gardens, and pollinated the plants that we knocked in. In fact, the percentage of flowers that made seed didn't differ on my restored plantings from natural populations in the region. Most of these bees, of course, are not honeybees, which are also introduced from Europe. They're these small little bees, which aren't nasty to people and are critical for the small flowers of our native plants. The next slide, 42, shows a way that a site manager can actually encourage pollinators, many bee species on site. Most of them nest in the ground, so you just knock down from a pickup truck soil on the surface, cost almost nothing. And this becomes nesting ground for wild bees, which then can serve us by pollinating and allowing the plants to produce seeds for the future. In this particular slide, number 42, we tried three kinds of soil just to see whether the bees prefer one soil texture over another. The results were not clear at all. But we had hundreds of bees on site. Similarly, you know, you might be in a part of America where the interest is not just in wildflowers and birds, but by other native wildlife. The next slide, 43, shows a case study from California. We're doing some work in Orange County, south of L.A., and there the interest is bringing back their really very unusual lizard community. Lizards are important in their own right, of course. They eat bugs, and they themselves become food for the birds. And just to bring back these whiptail lizards on site, it's not that hard. It just takes some attention. So after a remediation attempt, cleaning up toxins, some things have to happen to give the lizards their niche, their lifestyle, so they can survive and reproduce. They like some rocks so that they can cool up on cool mornings. They like sandy soil for making burrows and laying eggs. They look for dead wood where they can hide from birds and in the shade feed. During different stages of the summer, they need some shrubs to cool them from the hot California sun. What they eat, this particular species, are termites. So before we can introduce any of these darn lizards, we've got to make sure there are termites in that dead wood. Something most people don't think about, but it has to be done. To translocate critters to start the process, we need state permits. We monitor success and see, you know, have we gotten the right conditions? Do we have to add anything? Do we have to change anything? And then maybe add some more lizards so we have a diverse series of genotypes on site. Not hard things, not things that really cost very much money. They require some attention during restoration. In addition to your normal contractors, you probably need an environmental or biology company or a trustee to play a role to make sure these things can be reinstated. Next slide, 44, shows this land, one of the landfill sites after a few years' growth, about 6 years, and it looks pretty good. It looks like an abandoned farm with patches of woodlot. The trees and shrubs are growing. They're spreading out. The grass that was on site is dying under the shade. Birds are nesting here. There are small mammals and bunnies. It looks, dare I say it, almost normal and much more appealing than that mowed grass that was typical of landfill management in the past. Are we done? Well, not really. We've started the process of ecological restoration, but some attention is needed in the future. Let me give you one example of what I mean. Please go to 45. This shows a mature woodland in the east in the spring. And of course, the spring's when we get lots of these wildflowers on the ground. There's still sun on the ground because the tree leaves haven't opened. And this is a beautiful sight. Trilliums, jack-in-the-pulpits, violets, beautiful plants. And they're ecologically important, too, because they garner nutrients during the spring rain so it doesn't run off into our fresh water supplies. How do you get these trilliums in? Well, they need rich soil and they need shade as they mature. So you got to wait of several years till those trees I knocked in are shading the ground. But how are trilliums going to get to the site? Trillium seeds are not carried by the wind or by birds. Please go to slide 46. For example, here's a very common wildflower, Dutchman's breeches. It's called that because it looks like the pantaloons of the old Dutch settlers in America. The Latin is Dicentra for you Latin freaks. This is a common plant, and it's typical. Please go to the next slide. Its seeds are carried by ants. The ones on the left show a seed. They're only about 2 or 3 millimeters across, and each black seed has little white fatty things growing out of them. This is food for ants. The ant finds this, picks it up, carries it back to the nest to feed the babies, eats off the fat, and then deposits the seeds unharmed in their trash pile. Those are the four seeds on the right, and the seeds can then germinate and grow, having been moved from the mother plant. Again, it's just like that apple example I gave you before, except it's at the level of a forest floor, and ants, only ants are the dispersers. Ants are common. So this is how you do it. Now, if you want wildflowers in your restoration, you can't buy ant colonies at Home Depot. You've got to wait for time till a queen ant flies in, or you bring in ant colonies with topsoil and so on. You need time, and you also have to wait till the ground is shady. But for a full biodiversity, a full complement of this living cycle, you've got to wait a while and put people or some budget into your site several years later. Before we go on to 48, you can go to 48. That's the first of a series of case studies. I thought I'd pause now, and Dr. Rubin, if you want to see if there's any questions about what I've covered so far before we do the case studies.
That'd be great.
You're still awake, Ellen?
I'm still awake. I'm intently listening, as always. We have a couple questions here that have been written in. We can start with those, and then if people online have questions, they can hit *6 to unmute their line and then ask their question. The first question is from Ren in Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
And he wants to know, how do we address the changing ranges of natives as the climate changes? Is any agency doing this? Does planning for anticipated range, what might become native, consistent with executive
orders? Thank you. The question is, we all know that the climate's changing, and the ranges of most of our native plants is slowly shifting in response. When we do these restorations, we pay some special attention to, if anything, adding back species where this from a little bit south of our study site, knowing that 20, 40 years from now it's going to be warmer. So we don't put in species which are at the southern edge of their range. We put in species that are at the our study site or the remediation site is the middle of the range, or things that are we're at the northern range of things, knowing things are going to move up. And that's a very good question. The way to do it is locally, to get a local botanist or environmentalist to tell you, you know, what is the local habitat, what are the main key species, and what are the ones we should bring in. Phoenix, of course, has a wonderful group at Arizona State in urban ecology, and they would be a good resource. We have a little white paper, which we should post, on what are the sources of information to help you determine the target for restoration. One simple way is, of course, the Society for Ecological Restoration. They have a great website, ser.org. And from that, you can get a local expert to give you advice about the palette, and of course, your trustees may help also. Let me go to the next question, Ellen.
Okay, great. We have next couple questions about that landfill example.
Yeah.
The first question is from Michael in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he wants to know, with the cat landfill example, has the potential impact of root penetration in the clay cap be evaluated?
Oh, yeah, thanks so much, Mr. Ann Arbor. People always ask me that. We have published some papers, and the bibliographies that are available to you from this website include some papers about that. Living roots don't go through a clay cap or a geomembrane cap the way they're spec'd out in modern America. It's a red herring. Living roots are microscopic, and they're plastic. When they reach a barrier, like pyritic clay or a geomembrane, they turn and they ride the surface above the cap. Then they get thicker as they grow out, but it's above the cap. They don't penetrate the cap. I think a lot of civil engineers always are concerned about this because we all see roots pushing up sidewalks, so we know roots are sort of strong, but that's a very different biological process. That's a root that's in place just with hydraulic pressure pushing up on the sidewalk. On a landfill, as that root grows, it pushes down on the cap. It doesn't pierce the cap. Only the root tip can pierce, and that's microscopic and weak, and it turns. Some of the paper, we had to do this for the city of New York, and there's excellent resources both from England and America showing that that shouldn't be a concern. In fact, we have many landfill restorations now in the East with shrubs and trees, and it's been a great success.
There's also an EPA document that will address that. It's EPA document number 542F06001, which will come out in the next couple of months, and it's a fact sheet that addresses that question since we get it so much. So,
yeah, well, what's the name of that sheet, Ellen?
It is, I'm sorry, Use of Native Plants for Landfills and Waste Containment Areas.
Okay, so when it comes out, you could just search for landfill or roots, right, and they would find it.
Right.
Even if they can't memorize the number. Okay, thanks so much. It's something I'm always asked by engineers and site managers. Thank you.
Okay, let's have one more question from online, and then we'll go...
I don't have that many slides, folks, left, but let's do one now, and then we can have more questions at the end.
Okay. The last question here is from Chris in North Dakota. On the small and larger tree plant experiments, which worked better?
Oh, thanks. I forgot to give you the punchline. They all worked, even the ones of 7 plants, in terms of attracting birds and having seeds deposited onto them. So that link in nature worked for all of them, which is very encouraging. The difference became obvious after a few years. The very small ones don't trap dead leaves and litter. They all get blown away in the winter. So the soil under the smallest patches wasn't really improving. Also, the very smallest ones are sunny. I mean, there's sun shafts coming in on every side, so it's drier, the grass wouldn't die, and we didn't have sites where seedlings could get going. We needed the bigger ones, 42 and 70 trees and shrubs, where it was shady, leaf litter accumulated, and the grass was killed by shade, and then we could get the initiation of new seedlings. So there seemed to be a threshold limit, and you know, for now I'll say patches of about 30 to 40 are needed to start the real whole process going. It was sort of a surprise to us, and it didn't come out till 6 or 7 years. So the small ones, even though the trees are alive and birds come, are really crummy in terms of creating a microhabitat for new individual plants and eventually new habitat to get going. Thank you.
Okay, is there any questions on the line that people want to ask? Okay, why don't we then move on with the presentation?
Yeah,
people can ask questions.
Three little case studies I thought I'd give you to sort of build confidence that this really can be done, even in really crummy places. Slide 48. Let's just go through this one. This is a restoration that was done in Flushing Meadows Park in Queens, just a bit south of LaGuardia Airport and Shea Stadium, where the horrible Mets play. It's only about 5 miles away the beloved Yankees play, but that's another story. What we did here was go in after a construction job by the city to see what could be restored. So go to 49, please. This is a slide I showed you early on. Sewer pipe was put in. It was graded flat. And then we moved in to see what could be brought back for ecological services. Slide 50 shows a part of the site. We graded it down just really a few inches to where we could pool water to make a little freshwater wetland. And this, in fact, as you'll see, this wetland is persisting after about 10 years. We brought in a whole suite of native herbs here, herbaceous plants. Of course, some attention has to be paid to this. Some live in the water because they have to be in submerged water all the time. Some grow at the edge, like irises. Some grow a few inches above that. And where I'm standing taking this snapshot is only a few inches above the water, but it's dry. And there we had to put in other plants. So there's a whole series of zones here of that 15 species of herbs put into this horrible site to see what could happen. Slide 51 shows you the site after 3 years. and it's doing very nicely, thank you. Not everything persisted, but a lot of the rushes and wildflowers and native grasses are persisting. There are muskrats here, ducks nesting here, herons. It's a beautiful sight for the people, as well as now serving wildlife and migrants over the years. So we thought this was a pretty good success. Slide 52 is another project out in California, a very different habitat from New York. This is an arid site. This is in Orange County, about an hour south of Los Angeles. This was an old Marine Corps air base called El Toro, which was used since World War II. And the Pentagon closed it, and there was interest by the public who got control of the land to turn it into a park, which they optimistically called the Great Park, even though it hasn't been built yet. The scale of this is sort of enormous. The long runway here that goes down is about 2 miles long. About 600 acres of this site are concrete. And it's, of course, it's great as flat as a pancake because it was an air base. And around there are about 150 buildings, barracks, headquarters, hangars, and so on. That's all coming down to make a beautiful public park here, which is being designed right now. On the right side of the slide, you see a golf course that the Marines had. That's being maintained for now public use. What could be done in a site like this? There was interest not only in making this beautiful and sustainable, which means native plants, not things that have to be watered. I mean, there's only about 13 inches of water a year in this habitat, so the last thing they wanted was 1,500 acres of things that had to water every day. And they wanted connectors between preserves. So up on the top of the slide, you see a feet of land which is going to go up off the slide to Cleveland National Forest, which is a preserve nearby. And then towards the bottom of the slide, you see a little pointed tongue going down that hopefully will connect with a wildlife corridor to the Laguna Preserve land near the Pacific Ocean. So this was seen as a critical link to maintain movements of animals for long-term regional sustainability. And that's the goal of the park plan. The next slide shows you a recent restoration plan for this land that is still being tweaked. On the right side, you see that wildlife corridor, which is being carved out of what was the old air base, and that's going to go up and down to connect preserves. The next area shows a stream which was piped by the armed forces in World War II. That's going to be daylighted and made into a living stream in the middle of the slide, and also that's going to go up into the preserves and down into other existing stream corridors. So that'll be a very useful wildlife area linked up with the first one. And finally, there's a serpentine green structure we're calling the canyon, which is a new structure on this flat site. We're digging down 30 feet, 10 meters, piling the soil on the side. So we're going to have a canyon 60 feet down from the top of the berm down, which will be planted with pockets of native vegetation. And then we're putting some recycled water through it to make to hydrate it and give some wildlife habitat. And around these three natural areas will be park structures, playing fields, cultural zones, and so on, playing fields and so on. So even in this dry site, which was sort of a brownfield, in fact, the EPA and the Navy are doing a huge pump and treat system on the southern third of the site, some deep pollutants from the years when they were cleaning jet planes with solvents, and a lot of it was just allowed to leak into the soil. So that's going on as a pump and treat system while this public park is being built. So I think, again, a very optimistic possibility on a big landscape in one of the nation's biggest urban centers. The kinds of habitats here are diverse. Slide 54 shows what the main coastal sage scrub, like chaparral, but smaller and drier, oak woodlands and savannas, meadows and grasslands, which are almost extinct in Southern California because of the land uses, and streamside habitats from the daylighted stream and from the new recycled water we're putting in. So this will harbor a very rich series of biodiversity needs. Even that canyon we're digging out that's going to be 60 feet deep, slide 55 shows that in addition to a public amenity, a beautiful place for hiking and jogging and picnicking, it'll have ecological advantages. Critters can move through this. There'll be many, many microhabitats from wet to dry soil, north and south facing. We're changing the soil types, adding rocks to make the most possible species of plants and animals feel at home here. Movement will allow genetic diversity in the preserves as well as in this park. And by having new areas for many, many native species, will protect other already preserved areas from collapse. Critters and seeds could move in, what's called a rescue or metapopulation dynamic. So the ecological advantages add much value to the public need for a huge new park. To do a site like this is very similar to many EPA sites. 56 just briefly shows some of the things we're doing early on in the restoration process, which I encourage all of you to do on your sites. Save topsoil, which has microbes as well as organic matter. Save woody debris, critical habitat for bugs and small mammals and lizards. Find soil amendments, compost, biosolids. Secure stones, which are important microhabitats for seed dispersal as well as small animals. Test the site at the top. How appropriate is it for planting, as well as do we still have any toxins on site? Look, if you have any native seed stocks, save those plants, save those seeds. You have genotypically appropriate plants. And, of course, pay enormous attention to invasive species. You got to knock those out before you can put in our American heritage landscapes. The final example I want to give you on slide 57 is another brownfield. This one is in Beijing. We were asked to take a look at a site which is huge, twice the size of Central Park, where the Olympics are going to be in 08. The bottom part of this slide is where the games will be, all the stadium and arenas for swimming and so on. The top part, Forest Park, will be a huge restored landscape on an area that was an industrial zone in Beijing. The next slide shows a close-up of that. Again, a flat land that's being regraded and improved with a new lake, some hills, wetlands, meadows, different forest types, bringing back the historic diversity of the Beijing region, and this can then spread out and invigorate the whole region, as well as making a beautiful park for the worldwide visitors and the people in Beijing in a few years. The next slide shows a beautiful artistic rendering of that lake, showing restored wetlands, an educational boardwalk, a little island nesting area for wildfowl, and in the distance, the new Olympic Stadium, which is being built. If they can do it for the Olympics, they can do it in every part of this country, which has been degraded and is needing improvement. My final few slides are just some warnings, which I feel I have to give you. It's not easy doing restoration, and it's not my job today to say we can bring back what was here 500 years ago. The first constraints are ecological. It's hard for plants and animals to disperse. We have a fragmented world with highways and infrastructure. Second, the remaining plant and animal communities around your site are themselves degraded. They haven't been left alone in 500 years. They have invasives, the soil's been messed up, there's vandalism, and so on. Third, the soil needs attention. Very often the soil represents old fill, contamination, and so on. Next, successional processes are often gone. We need natural disturbance for vegetation. Fires and flooding is changed now in our population centers. You have to think about what is really going on here, what can be sustainable in the future. And finally, invasive species keep growing. We have more and more species every year. The government's trying very hard to keep them under control, to stop them. It's an enormous part of environmental management today. The next slide is regulatory constraints, things that we as land managers have to keep in mind. First, ecology and engineering are two different fields. We have to learn to work together. On landfills, they often want to grade that site as tight and as high bulk density as possible. That's the last thing I want for my beloved plants. Often things are put in to, because they know in an engineering sense they'll last a long time, but bioengineering solutions sometimes are more appropriate. In fact, the trees I put in a landfill transpire water. They intercept water. The amount of leachate on a wooded landfill is 30% less than on a landfill that just has grass. So we've got to work together for both of our needs. Rooting zone is poor, as I've already stressed. Instead of just saying clean fill is needed on the site, we've got to look at specs for soil so that it's appropriate for a sustainable plant community, giving public value for long into the future. Disturbance regimes may have to be brought back, although burning isn't permitted in many of our cities. And we have to phase construction properly. Don't spend all your money in the first few years. Some money has to be reserved for monitoring and bringing in new species later on. The final constraint side is number 62, constraints of us as people. Beauty in the eye of the beholder. Not everybody wants a wildflower meadow. And I've been at sites where people have said, please mow it down. There's bugs there. I hate bugs. Or please mow it down. I want to play frisbee with my kids. You've got to think about the social needs around the site. What will the local community want and tolerate if it's really going to be sustainable? Different strokes for different folks. Again, green reuse is great, of great value, and is an EPA priority in many sites. But some people want a ratable. They really want a strip mall or a parking lot. You've got to see what is the real end use which will be tolerated by the people who control the land. The numbers game. Not all species live on all size habitats. If you have a very small site, just a few acres, not all plants and animals can live there. You've got to think of what is the appropriate target for your ecological goals. What's the target that people will tolerate for greenery? I want to be alone, the old Greta Garbo line. I can't tell you what it's like as an environmentalist, maybe you all know, what it is to go into a political office or a regulator's office and say, hi, I'm a local botanist, this is what I want to do to change how you close your land. These people are so busy with such small staffs and tight budgets, they often don't have time to change their traditional protocols. We just need patience and have to keep plugging at it. And finally, here comes the sun, a question that was already asked today. We live in a warming world. We've got to think of ecological goals that really will live for many, many decades, not just things which are historic or rare species. A lot of the environmental community wants rare things brought back. It's so hard, particularly in a changing world. And my final slide is opportunities. I don't want to leave on a negative note. By adding restoration to our work, to thinking about it after the soil or pollutants are cleaned up, we have a chance to bring back much of the natural heritage of this country, to restore ecological functions for our people, for our communities, to minimize management needs and costs, which will help us in the long term as tax dollars get so few and far between. We have a chance to enrich surrounding areas by adding species onto our restored sites. They can spread out through time. And, of course, anything we add gives us resiliency for the future so that if certain preserved areas are destroyed or damaged, we have new areas nearby to bring them back to ecological health. And the final slide is a thank you, and I'll thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Handel.
Okay, Ellen, you want to be the moderator again?
Sure. So if everyone wants to click you on the last email, slide 64, where it says links to additional resources, if you just click on that, that will bring you just what it says, so there's additional resources. You can download today's seminar for future reference. There's a whole bunch of additional information, references and articles. And on the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see feedback. And if you click on that, that's where you can provide any comments about the presentation, internet presentations in general, and we do read them and try to address all of them. So we hope to get some of your feedback. So why don't we open up the line now to questions, since we didn't really get a chance during the break. If anybody on the phone line has a question, if you can just maybe state your name if you're comfortable with that or where you're from and ask your question, that would be great. And to if you're on mute, just hit star 6 to unmute your line. Any questions on the line? Okay, we have...
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Do you think the Yankees are going to win the pennant?
I'm astonished when they don't win. I'll answer this quickly. It's been a nice year for the Yankees. A lot of their all-stars were injured, and they still won their division. So it's going to be a battle. Some of the other teams like Minnesota look terrific. So I'm crossing my fingers and my toes. I'll see you in October.
We have one question left that someone wrote in. I'm not sure if you've addressed this maybe already. This is bad too. Planning on landfills, and John from Texas wanted to know what the potential for generating unwanted leachate was.
Finn, the studies I'm aware of show just the opposite, that the roots don't go through the cap, and living a woody plant community intercepts and transpires 30% of the precipitation, so that the leachate is cut back by a third if you put woodies on rather than just hydroseeding grass, if that's your question.
Yeah, I think that's the question. Great. So somebody answered a question but seems to be gone. So if I didn't answer your question and you wrote it in, can you please submit it again? Any other questions on the line that anyone had?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Mike from Philadelphia area.
Yes.
Just in general, have you seen the regulators when you're going in to restore such sites? Have the regulators been accepting to the idea of planting the small clusters versus planting the entire site? We see a lot of times they want 85% coverage and survivability within the first 5 years of a site's restoration.
Yeah, this has to be a dialogue. The traditional approach, of course, is that the whole surface should be green. And you really can't afford to do that with woodies. What we recommend is never hydroseeding with fescues, you know, the normal contractor's mix, but put in native grasses which are green and pretty, but they're clumpy and they leave space. They still bind the soil, but they leave openings for seeds of later species, wildflowers or trees and shrubs, to move in. So as long as you say, look, the soil won't erode, we'll have really nice habitat for different kinds of critters, they seem to like that. The magic words I use are wildflowers and shade from new trees. And that's just so obvious and appealing to people. That's pretty good. And we have, you know, some case histories now that we can point to so that they feel confident that this is not an experimental system.
Thanks. Do you have any more questions on the phone lines?
Yes, I have one. Charlie Brigance, TCEQ, Texas. I've got a site in West Texas that they told us they're going to use trimmings that have been rooted.
Yes.
In the riparian zone. These would be cottonwoods, things like that.
Yeah, fascines. I'm familiar with the technique.
Is that more successful than putting potted plants?
No, it's not more successful. It works. It's more cost effective. Of course, they can put bare root stuff in that, they call them live stakes or fascines. It's been used for decades in Europe, and it's taken a hold in this country too. It's faster and cheaper than putting in containerized or B&B stock. As long as the key thing, of course, is the material has to be handled properly. Those little roots can't dry out, and they've got to plant them, at the very earliest part of the spring, so they get that whole growing season to take off. If you plant them when the water table's low, they'll just die, and it's a waste of time. So you need a contractor who's familiar with working with the rooted, the live stakes or the fascines. But it does work. Here in the East Coast, it's been touted as an inexpensive way of doing bioengineering on stream sides and riverine corridors.
Okay, how does it work for, how do they work in areas with extreme climatic changes? Hot summers, cold winters, and like that.
Well, if the species is a native species, with the right willows and so on, they still should, okay. The key is the timing, and then a lot of these things fail because there's so much, construction going on, and the phasing is subject to so many things, and the planting goes in too late, and then you really can't get these things established before that dry spell comes in. So that's the weak link in the whole system. Unless there's a budget for watering trucks and so on, and sometimes the site's big and you can't do that.
It's supposed to have an subsurface irrigation system, but I'm...
Yeah, well, if the contractor has that in the contract and it's part of his bond guarantee, you have some protection. But even then, you want to make sure the timing of it is right, you know, sort of, right towards the tail end of your winters, when the things can really be well watered naturally. That kind of bioengineering of stream slopes has become more and more popular in all parts of the country, and generally we recommend that for stabilization over the old riprap techniques.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve. Let me give a plug. If you're interested in this topic, there's another internet seminar next week, September 28th, next Thursday, from 11 a.m. to 1:15 Eastern Time. That's hosted by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. It's a state-led organization, and their internet training is on planning and promoting of ecological reuse of remediated sites. And you can register through that either through the CLUIN website, as you did this internet seminar, or through the ITRC website. We have another question that was written in. So this is from Michael from Michigan. Have any of the native species been evaluated for phytoremediation potential beyond just uptake precipitation?
Phytoremediation is of great interest to a lot of people in the agency. And it's a mixed bag. Let's start with that. Much of phytoremediation, of removing toxins from the soils, has to do with microbes that grow on the roots of plants, and they break down many, many hydrocarbons. There are some plants that are useful for the uptake of heavy metals, and there's, as you can imagine, a lot of research on that. Where they put in mustards or some other annuals, the plants suck up the heavy metals, and then the crop is really harvested. It's cut and brought together, ashed, and then sent to a toxic waste dump. But it's out of the soil. And many varieties of these plants have been developed, which are pretty good. Native plants really don't remove heavy metals from the soil. Their root systems can break down hydrocarbons. A lot of plants like poppers have been used for this because they're fast growing and their roots are fast growing. So that process of microbial breakdown of soil toxins goes on reasonably fast. And of course, they're trees that grow in sterile, modest conditions. It is being used. I don't think it's still widely used, and I can't say that it's really an alternative to the EPA traditional chemical engineering approaches and so on yet. But it's an area that both the agency and a lot of research labs are looking at. Keep tuned. You may want to add something to that.
Yeah, I can elaborate a little bit more on that. That's my specialty. And we consider phytoremediation an innovative technology. And if you look on the CLUIN website, you can get a lot of information on phytoremediation. And just to clarify what Steve was saying is, a lot of research has been done with metals. It has not been a success with metals. We haven't found any silver bullet that would uptake most of the metals, so it hasn't been that successful in the metals arena, but with chlorinated solvents, hydrocarbons, some even pesticides, we've had much better success. Okay. Any questions on the phone line? Okay, well, we have another question that was written in, and this is from Raymond in Missouri. Could you talk about using natives first? When do issues with exotics and physical changes on the site make addressing these issues more important than using native species?
I'm not sure I understand. You mean if there's already exotics on the site? Read that section.
Yeah, when do issues with exotics and physical changes on the site make addressing these issues more important than using native species?
Well, on any of these sites, I mean, if you're starting off with an alien community, the first thing I would say is you got to knock those out, either by mechanical or chemical means. I have a friend in the Midwest who was trying to do a native wildflower prairie, and she said she spent 2 years just knocking out the weed seeds before she put in the natives, and now it's a big success. So the soil quality and the presence of aliens have to be remediated first, and then you can move into a happier, sustainable community. I hope I've answered the
needs. Yeah, I hope so. If that doesn't answer your questions, can you write in again? Any other questions on the phone line?
Yeah, this is Mike from Philadelphia again. Have you had any success or any issues with predation, such as deer issues on your rescue plant sites? And if so, have you dealt with some of those things?
Yes, deer. And throughout the East Coast, I mean, there's a superabundance of deer, which is a well-known issue. Deer are a real problem. And, you know, in some sites, we say, you know, can you fence it? Can you put in a temporary, you know, 8-foot fence to keep the deer out till this establishment?
No.
I'm still here. Yeah. On other sites.
Are you there?
Hello? Ellen, are you there? We may have lost Ellen, but you haven't lost me.
No, you only lost me for a second. I'm back.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
We're dealing with what do you do about deer predation? For some young tree plantings, there are simple, inexpensive mechanical remedies. There's things called tree guards, which look like plastic gutters, which are like a buck and a half each, and you can put those in young trees, and that stops deer from eating the bark or rubbing their antlers against it. And this has been used a lot, actually right outside Philadelphia at Pennypack Ecological Reserve. They've done most of the research on this. And that'll get your forest going until they're big enough to avoid the deer. And those plastic sheaths just sort of slough off after a while. Other sites, you try to overwhelm the deer herd by just putting in a lot. If you're doing in patches, you might just put a fence around that patch. But you can't, if there is a superabundance of deer, you probably have to go towards a wildflower solution, wildflower meadow, which, because of their fecundity, can tolerate, you know, some deer eating them and still reproduce over time.
Okay, great. We don't have any questions written in, so unless there's any more questions on the line, one more opportunity to ask Dr. Handel some questions. So if you come up with a question later, you have his email address, so you could ask him it then.
Oh, this is Charlie Brigance again. Do you ever get rid of Johnson grass?
Well, in sites when you have a noxious weed, grass like that, it's really hard. And I'll tell you the solutions I know about. Some people, of course, say, well, look, let's just put a new layer of soil over it and just bury it, if that's a solution. That isn't always a solution. Alternatively, I mean, if you just go on with Roundup and do a heavy treatment of that, in a few years, you can knock it out and hydroseed it with native grasses, which will grow up and crowd it out. There are certainly places where the alien pressure is so high, the realistic thing is that, look, we can't put in anything on the ground. We can start with some taller things. I'll give you an example. You could put in some patches of young trees and shrubs. And if you have a lot of Johnson grass, just use Roundup on strips around it. So you have some areas you can manage and make those areas where new seedlings will come up. If you have neither time nor money or to deal with an entire site. So you can start making pockets of healthy biodiversity, and at least that will give you some structure for the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any more questions online? All right, well, Dr. Handel, I want to thank you again for another very informative and fascinating presentation. And
well,
thank
that's
you
very kind, Dr. Handel.
Thank you all for listening.
I'm a headquarters person.
Thank you all for listening, and stay tuned. We have, like you heard, next week there's an ITRC training on ecological restoration, and in 2 weeks there's an internet training that Dr. Handel spoke of that talks more about the soil health, which is, I think, Jumpstarting Ecological Restoration Phase 2, I think we've named it. So look forward to those upcoming internet seminars. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for your interest. Best of luck to you all.